Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monaco 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week of coverage on Monaco 24, with highlights from our studios here in Midori House and from around the world. This week, the former police chief, now mayor of Tampa, discusses the challenges of police reform in the U.S.
The officers that will be removed as a result of a reduction in budget are, you know, the last ones to be hired, which quite often are minority officers. And, you know, those officers that are coming in with a servant's heart.
Plus, Olia Hercules, the author of the brand new Summer Kitchens, shares one of her favorite recipes from Ukraine.
One of my favorite Ukrainian recipes that I found in a 1905 Ukrainian cookbook is burnt aubergine on toast with tomatoes and garlic, and it's a very easy one to prepare.
All that and much, much more in the next hour here on The Curator with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, let's begin today's show with a big story from the past week. The UK and the European Union have expressed concern and anger after China passed a new security law giving it new powers over Hong Kong. Sir Malcolm Rifkin, who was the UK's foreign secretary for much of the period leading up to the handover of Hong Kong in July 1997, told a briefing on Tuesday about the significance of the controversial legislation.
Well, it's pretty grim news for Hong Kong, and typical of the Chinese government and Xi Jinping, it may astonish your listeners to know that the detail of this law has still not been published. We are entirely dependent on stories coming out of China as to what is actually in it. We've got a pretty good idea, I suspect. But isn't it appalling that a law is passed which will impose major restrictions on the people of Hong Kong? The first time Chinese government have tried to do that, ignoring the terms of the joint agreement, the treaty under which Hong Kong returned to China, and they do not even have the decency to publish the details in advance so they can be discussed, and some attempt could have been perhaps made to modify their implications.
You are quite right that the Chinese Communist Party has not yet taken the step of letting everybody know the detail of what is in this law, but from what we do understand of it, how great a divergence is it from the promises that would have been made leading up to the handover in 1997 about where things would be 23 years later?
Well, remember, the agreement that led to the handover in 1997 was for 50 years, and therefore there are another 23 years still to go. And this wasn't a unilateral gesture by the Chinese government, which they're entitled to change when it suits them. This was an international treaty signed by the Chinese government and the United Kingdom government, and it was with agreement of the Chinese, it was deposited at the United Nations as an international treaty. And the one thing you can be 100% certain of is it does not allow for the Chinese rubber stamp parliament to pass laws for the people of Hong Kong. That was expressly excluded. That's what two systems in one country is meant to mean. But it's even worse than that, because what the Hong Kong still enjoys up till today is what we call the rule of law. They have independent courts, and as in the United Kingdom or the United States or any free country, if the government tries to break the law, the government can be stopped by the courts. In order to ensure that does not happen on this very, very draconian measure, the Chinese government have announced, and we assume they mean it, that they are going to have special judges who will be chosen by Carrie Lam, who's their tame chief executive in Hong Kong, who acts on their behalf ultimately, and she will decide who the judges will be who will hear any appeals that suggest that the Chinese law is not even legal in Hong Kong. So that demonstrates when you're dealing with a totalitarian government, sadly, this is what you have to anticipate.
You and six other former UK foreign secretaries recently came together, and this is a bipartisan initiative, foreign secretaries from right across the political spectrum, urging the UK to take a lead on Hong Kong. But isn't it the case that China resents Britain's interjections on this subject pretty much more than it does anybody else's?
Well, of course you're right, and that's because they know how guilty they are. And what they say is whenever we point out that they are breaking the two systems in one country treaty that they themselves signed, they accuse us of interfering in their own internal affairs and they suggest that that agreement in 1997 is merely of historical significance. Well, they know themselves that's complete rubbish. If you have a treaty, the terms of which specifically state this treaty will apply for 50 years in the form included in the treaty, and if it's signed by the Chinese government and deposited at the United Nations, of course Britain and the rest of the international community, because it's not just the United Kingdom, are making clear that the Chinese government under Xi Jinping are doing themselves great, great harm. Now, the sad truth is, of course, we all know that China's a very powerful country and that protests from other countries will not necessarily stop it in its tracks. What we have to do is two points I would make. First of all, we will now have to see over the next few weeks and months how they apply this law. Is it going to be applied as it's technically possible for them to do, thereby destroying the freedom of Hong Kong? Because if they do, what will happen is they will destroy Hong Kong as a valuable asset. The young, very able Hong Kongers, they will leave Hong Kong. They're not going to submit themselves to being subjects of a dictatorship for the rest of their lives. They'll get out. Some will come to Britain, some will go to America, Canada, Taiwan, Singapore, all sorts of places around the world. And in addition to that, the Hong Kong business community will know that Hong Kong is no longer attractive because it will no longer be able to guarantee the rule of law for those wanting to invest either in Hong Kong itself or through Hong Kong into China. So what the international community, led, I hope, by the United Kingdom, because we have a special responsibility as one of the signatories of the treaty, have to do our best to persuade Xi Jinping and his colleagues. We can't stop them doing this if they insist, but they will lose more than they'll gain, because the Hong Kong they will control in a few weeks or a few months or 1 or 2 years' time will be simply a hollow shell of no economic value, with nobody there, perhaps sadly elderly people, perhaps. But all the young, vigorous people in Hong Kong and many of the international businesses will have packed up and gone. And what a tragedy that would be.
Sir Malcolm Rifkin there, the former Foreign Secretary of the UK, in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Muller. Next to another story making headlines this week, and it's to the latest edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer that we turn to next. This week, Iran issued an arrest warrant for US President Donald Trump over January's killing of Iranian General Qassem Soleimani and asked Interpol for its help enforcing it. Andrew Muller looks at what Iran might actually be trying to achieve with such an unlikely move.
He's been called a monster, and he was a monster. And he's no longer a monster. He's dead. And that's a good thing for a lot of countries. And he was planning a very big attack and a very bad attack for us and other people. And we stopped him.
Such has been the giddying lunacy of 2020's news cycle that the assassination of the Iranian general Qassem Soleimani by the United States seems an event densely shrouded by time's mists, a half-remembered fable of a long bygone era. It happened just 6 months ago. Insufficient time, it now turns out, for Iran to have gotten over it. The Islamic Republic has issued a warrant for the arrest of US President Donald Trump, among a few dozen other American officials that Iran wishes to charge with murder and terrorism, if you don't mind. Iran has earnestly importuned Interpol for its assistance in detaining President Trump at their earliest convenience. Before we examine the chances of Trump ending up in the dock, and they are slender, at least for this, a recap is probably in order for thunderstruck listeners who are still thinking, what? Was that this year? How is that even possible?
Hello. In a dramatic escalation of tensions in the Middle East, a US airstrike has killed Iran's most important military commander.
Major General Qassem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign and covert operations wing of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. He was the architect of Iran's frequently bloody and brutal interventions abroad, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and still further afield, and by some estimates the second most powerful figure in the Iranian regime, deferring only to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Just after midnight on January 3rd, Soleimani was leaving Baghdad International Airport when his convoy was hit by missiles launched from an American drone. Soleimani was killed instantly, along with several others.
Americans and Zionists should know that my father's martyrdom has led to a greater awakening of the people's consciousness on the resistance front, and it will bring about dark days for them and flatten their homes.
Iran, which saw this much as the US might have seen Iran whacking its vice president, swore revenge. A few days after Soleimani's vast funeral in Tehran, at which at least 56 people were trampled to death, Iran rocketed two US bases in Iraq. Enough of a racket was raised that several dozen American troops suffered concussion injuries, but that was the extent of the casualties. It seemed clear enough that Iran's retaliation had been carefully choreographed in advance so as not to escalate matters beyond anyone's control. But it was also apparent that Tehran was not ready to call it a draw.
These American clowns, who with lies and utter evil say they stand by the Iranian people, they should see who the Iranian people are. ببینن مردم ایران کی هستند.
Which brings us to the question of where Iran thinks it is going with this latest stunt. It is difficult to imagine that we will be treated to the spectacle of deputies from the US Marshal Service empowered by an Interpol red notice kicking down the doors of the White House to serve Iran's warrant. Interpol, indeed, with an all but audible sigh, has already stated that it wants nothing to do with this. Interpol's constitution, it reminded in a statement, forbids any intervention or activities of a political, military, religious, or racial character. This endeavour by Iran appears to tick at least two of those boxes. Interpol continued, therefore, if or when any such requests were to be sent to the General Secretariat, Interpol would not consider requests of this nature. This is probably as close as Interpol will ever get to threatening to itself arrest a complainant for wasting police time. It has also been an act of heroic restraint on the part of Interpol to rise above referring to the length of the Crimes Against Humanity rap sheet that could have been assembled under Soleimani's name. Iran's purpose in flying this particular kite appears twofold. First and foremost, it is to remind the world that Iran does not consider the Soleimani account settled. Iran may still hope to leverage this grievance for concessions or deploy it as a justification for some future attack on US interests. Secondly, Iran hopes to discombobulate President Trump. It is significant that Iran's demand for his arrest specified that this is something that they intend to pursue even after Trump leaves office. The spectre Iran is summoning here is perhaps that of Augusto Pinochet, the Chilean tyrant who was arrested in London by British police bearing a warrant issued by a Spanish judge in 1998, nearly a decade after the end of his presidency. Closer to home, Trump may be uncomfortably reminded of the travails of former US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, his globe-trotting now curtailed not merely by his advanced age, but by the possibility of a foreign judge wanting a word with him about the consequences of certain of his policies. What Iran is not doing, really, is making any kind of serious point about international law and accountability and the Geneva Conventions and similar niceties. If they were, the last person they would be presenting as a test case would be Qassem Soleimani, who was never known for his own interest in such things. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Andrew Muller there with the latest edition of the Foreign Desk Explainer. Next up, we hear a highlight from the late edition earlier this week. The reform of policing in many parts of the world is still the subject of debate and demonstration in several cities. One person who may understand the challenges surrounding the issue of police reform better than most is Jane Castor. She's the mayor of the city of Tampa in Florida. She has been in the post for little more than a year, having served as the city's police chief for 6 years. When she was appointed to lead Tampa's police department in 2009, she became the first woman and the first openly gay person to hold the position. Monaco's Thomas Lewis spoke to her and began by asking whether her tenure as police chief had given her a better understanding of what demonstrators were calling for in the wake of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, or whether protesters in Tampa saw her still as part of the institution they were protesting against.
Well, actually, the answer to both of those questions is yes. It was both helpful and a hindrance. You know, everyone cried out in protest about the murder of George Floyd. And so we in the city of Tampa tried to provide a safe platform in which demonstrators could express themselves in any, you know, any form that they felt necessary. And the only two rules that we imposed was no property damage or violence. And that's the way that we have always approached demonstrations in our community. And so it depends. I would say that my scorecard depends on who you talk to.
Do you feel, you know, on a personal level, that given that you're someone who knows how the police works in Tampa in such an intricacy and over such a long mm-hmm. period of time, you've seen changes to policing at first hand. Is there a frustration mm-hmm. for you about getting that knowledge across, if you like, when the,
yes.
the popular feeling is, you know, very, very explicitly sort of camped in one corner of the debate, if you like?
Yes. And it's frustrating for me from a number of angles. First and foremost, the lack of understanding of what police officers do on a day-to-day basis. The vast majority of a police officer's duties involves social work. And so one of the things that I have always said is that we ask our police officers to do too much. While as a state and a nation, we underfund so many social services, including mental health, addiction, our educational system, you know, all of those systems that are underfunded. And the associated problems from that fall into the laps of the police officers who are neither trained nor equipped to appropriately handle those situations. So I believe that the light shone on police reform, that hopefully that will have a positive effect. Another area that is frustrating is that in Tampa, we have worked for decades on our relationship with the community. And as a matter of fact, we are one of the safest cities in the nation for our size because of that partnership with the community. And our golden rule at the Tampa Police Department is that everyone is treated with dignity and respect, no matter who it is. That's something that we have really prided ourselves on, and also the level of transparency and accountability within the police organization. Unfortunately, there are no national policing standards in America, and we have 18,000 police departments. So for an example, the carotid restraint, which is quite often referred to as the chokehold, in some fashion or form, you're cutting off the oxygen to an individual's brain. The Tampa Police Department has not allowed that technique for over three decades, but there are still departments clearly throughout the United States that allow that technique to be utilized. So it's something that I'm looking forward to the future on a number of levels. One is that we have some type of federal standards for law enforcement. And then two, that the grief, anger, and frustration over the murder of George Floyd will somehow translate into addressing these systemic issues that have held our communities down for decades, if not centuries.
A big call by many of the protests that have been taking place, not only in the US, but here in Canada and the UK as well, has been to defund the police so that that money can go to exactly those institutions. You said that if they were funded correctly at the grassroots level, I suppose, solve a lot of the problems that later down the line police officers are then confronted with. Is that a call, therefore, you would...
Yeah, I hear that, and I understand the overarching philosophy of that. But if you dig down into it pragmatically, if you look at a police department's budget, over 90% is for personnel. So what you're saying is, we don't want police officers in neighborhoods. And the officers that will be removed as a result of a reduction in budget are, you know, the last ones to be hired, which quite often are minority officers. And, you know, those officers that are coming in with a servant's heart. But again, from a pragmatic standpoint, the police department is the only organization that is out in the neighborhoods 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to answer any call that comes in. The Tampa Police Department, we have 972 police officers. We have a population of just over 400,000, and the Tampa Police Department answers over 1 million calls for service each year. So to say you're going to take funding out of law enforcement and put it into these other social services, it can't be done unless there's a safety net that will cover the interim. You know, who's going to answer the call at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning for someone who is in crisis, suffering from mental illness? Who's going to provide the Narcan to the individual who has overdosed? Who's going to respond to the domestic violence calls? So I understand that overarching philosophy, but we need to look at the practicality of doing that.
That was Jane Castor, the mayor of the city of Tampa in Florida, speaking to Monocle's Thomas Lewis earlier this week. Stay in the U.S. now for a highlight from Meet the Writers. Capricia Marshall was chief of protocol of the U.S. under Barack Obama. In her new book, Protocol, Why Diplomacy Matters and How to Make It Work for You, she gives us an insight into the backstage workings of the White House, a snapshot of her friendship with the Clintons and the Obamas, and a very useful guide to soft power on a political and a personal level. For last weekend's edition of Meet the Writers, Capricia spoke to the show's host, Georgina Godwin. Here is a highlight.
So your role as US Chief of Protocol, let's just examine that a bit. First of all, I mean, a very basic question, but what is protocol?
Well, first off, I will say that I have always considered protocol to be a superpower. Protocol, it really starts the wheels of diplomacy. It lays out a well-defined roadmap for every interaction, no matter the size, between our global leaders. And it is important. It's very important because it gives them the steps through which to take when they are having those very important meetings so that they can focus on the policy objectives at hand. When I create the environment for them, and that is the room size, what language will be attended to, the seating arrangements, down to the pens that will be used, including also their mindset, really putting their heads in the right space before they enter that critical negotiation or discussion or signing treaty. It's all of those elements together help prepare then the president or the secretary of state to succeed in that engagement with their counterpart. You know, I am reminded of an example of early on in the administration working with President Obama when we traveled to a G20. And this is a multilateral engagement. And one of his, what a really big meeting that he was going to have was with President Putin of Russia. And this was the first time he was going to be meeting with President Putin as president. I received the briefings from the NSC as to exactly what was on the agenda. And so I knew how to put all of the details of this meeting together. And one that became quite critical was the size of the room. And, you know, we wanted him to feel a bit cornered. We wanted him to feel pressured into engaging in on those issues that were tough and that President Obama wanted to raise with President Putin and see if they can find some alignment on these issues. And the room size helped them do that by bringing them closer together and really making it feel like we're forcing you into addressing these issues. And the ceiling height actually of that room was quite low, which is known to push people into making more concrete decisions. We felt like our roadmap was successful. And in the readout afterwards, it was stated by both leaders that they felt like they came to some real agreement, some real alignment.
I mean, and the book is full of examples like that. I particularly like the fact that Clinton, and in fact, this is a summit that's just taken place recently, which was New START, the Russian and American negotiations over a nuclear treaty. But you made sure that the leaders would appear the same height in the photograph, which of course put the Russians completely at ease and really made them regard you in such a kindly way.
Yes, this is President Obama and President Medvedev of Russia. He was then president. And this is an important signing. We, again, attended to every detail. I had top staff with me, Asel Roberts, who spoke Russian, she speaks Russian fluently. And we worked hand in hand with our counterparts. It was our first engagement with my counterpart, the chief of protocol. And, you know, so you're sizing one another up. You're trying to figure out where this relationship is going to go. And when we saw the stage, we looked at it and we said, golly, you know, this is not going to work for President Medvedev. And I pointed it out to my counterpart because they present and they give you the chairs. And we knew that President Obama really would tower over President Medvedev. And so I turned to her and I said, I think we need to get some help here. We need to raise up President Medvedev's chair so he would be on equal footing with President Obama. And it wouldn't look like a teacher schooling, you know, their student. And so we did. We went to the folks at the who were assisting us in the Czech Republic, and they quickly added a couple of inches to the chair at the bottom. And when they did, it really made an enormous difference. When President Obama and President Medvedev sat at that table, there was parity in the relationship. It was two global partners coming together to find common ground in signing this treaty. It wasn't whereby one would be lesser than the other, because the visual is so very important in protocol. It communicates so very much. And in addition to, of course, making sure that we had that moment, my counterpart, Marina, grew to be a friend. And we knew that we could work with one another and trust one another in trying to make these engagements for our leaders work to not only our benefit, but to the overall endeavor and goal.
Capricia Marshall, former chief of protocol of the US and author in conversation with Monaco's Georgina Godwin. Stay in the literary world and with the US next on The Curator. The Vanishing Half is the new novel by American writer Britt Bennett. In it, we meet identical twin sisters, Desiree and Stella, growing up in 50s small town Louisiana. The twins are black, but light-skinned, and as they get older, their lives take very different paths, as one sister chooses to live as a white woman and the other black. The novel has been attracting rave reviews and storming the bestseller charts since its release a couple of weeks ago. And on this week's Monocle on Culture, Robert Bound spoke to the author, Britt Bennett, to find out more.
So you started with the two sisters, the two twins. That's got all sorts of wonderful associations with it. I mean, we're in Bible territory, we're in Greek myth territory here. Did you kind of, I don't know, read around that subject, or were they kind of fully born and bred characters in your mind from the get-go?
Yeah, I was really interested in the mythological nature of it. Like you said, their twins hold such a a special place in a lot of belief systems. Whether some cultures twins are considered lucky, some cultures they're considered very unlucky. And that was something that became interesting to me as I was kind of writing towards myth, and I think a few different ways in this book. So that was something that I thought about. I think as far as how the twins turned out, I just didn't want them to feel, you know, two polar opposite where it felt a little cute, where, you know, one is this way and one is the complete opposite way of that. I wanted them to feel like these two girls who grow up together, who are so inseparably close, but then eventually make these choices that lead them onto their various paths in life.
Yeah. And through such sort of tumultuous changes, and mostly for themselves, I mean, it's reflected in America from the 1950s through to the late 1980s, early 1990s, right? American history seeps into the story, of course it must, but you kind of keep it focused on the kind of roller coaster that your characters are riding there. These are two women who are ineluctably caught up in the history of their and the civil rights of their nation and their era. So I wonder how tough it was to keep all that very obviously political stuff out and keep it in the character.
Yeah, I think when I was writing the book, I thought about history as a backdrop more than anything. You know, I don't even really think of this as historical in the sense that there are, you know, so many historical novels that are so deeply interested in all of the kind of intricate details of the time period and the era. And for me, I was less interested in that. I thought about the idea of, you know, for example, you open the book in the wake of Dr. King's assassination. I wanted to start there in part because my mother, who grew up in Louisiana, arrived in D.C. the week that Dr. King was killed. So it was the first time she had ever been anywhere. And this is where she like has appeared in like the middle of history. So there's always something that was so wild about that to me, to hear that story from her. But I think also there's that friction between this, you know, you're a 19-year-old in the middle of history, but you also are like living on your own for the first time and you're moving into an apartment and you're trying to find furniture. And like, those are your daily concerns. So I always loved that kind of back and forth of what it feels like to be alive at any moment, but especially a large historical moment. So I wanted to think about the history influencing the characters in some ways. So, you know, that section, you know, there's a character who Desiree is able to escape from this bad marriage because of the chaos of the moment. So that moment does influence her in some way, but also she is concerned about her emotional crisis that is her marriage as much as she's concerned about this larger historical crisis that's happening around her.
At those times in the book, there are, I can see that's very much about being a woman and being a woman of that time, let alone of color or not. It's obviously a novel about race and about the history of it in the United States, and you can transpose that across continents as well. But are you interested also in it very much being a novel about what it is to be a woman?
Yeah, I think that it's all of those things interconnected, like you said. You know, I think in part the options that are available to these women are so narrow, and they're narrow because of race, but also because of gender. You know, I think an example for that is Stella, who's a really smart woman. You know, she doesn't know if she can go into college because her family doesn't have money to afford it. And then, you know, later in the book, she takes this job where she becomes involved with somebody who works there. And there is sort of a, you know, as time goes by, she begins to kind of reevaluate that and think about, you know, was this actually a romance? Was this actually manipulative? Was this actually an abuse of power? But that is, you know, her kind of way to access this world of wealth and power is through this relationship that begins under very dubious circumstances. So I think of those types of experiences, and I think also her experience just in general as she chooses to work, and all of these choices that she makes are, again, these kind of tenuous choices at the time, because she's kind of a well-off woman and, you know, her husband's like, but you don't need to work. Why do you want to? So I think, yeah, I was interested, I think, in that time period because it was a moment of change in a lot of different ways. Race, you know, gender, sexuality, all of these sort of scripts and expectations were being challenged in ways that are continuing to be felt now.
So obviously the crux bit of the book are the twins, one of whom passes for white, one of whom stays black, as it were. your narrator has a very strong voice, they're kind of omniscient narrator, I suppose you'd call it. Again, how certain are you in the voice of your narrator, who judges both characters and the whole scene that they preside over? How long did it take to get that voice right?
I think it took a while. I mean, I love an omniscient narrator. I know that I feel like that's fallen out of fashion as time has gone by, but I love a judgy omniscient narrator. I love the idea of you know, being very consciously told a story. You know, I love stories that announce themselves as such, as somebody kind of, I'm going to tell you a tale. And I think that this is the type of narrator at the story. I love when narrators hint at things that have not yet been revealed or have not yet happened. So I love all of those kind of details of omniscience. And I think for me, I started to think about this as kind of almost the voice of the town or the voice of the community, that it's this narrator that knows all the things that have happened in this place, that is able to duck into these lives of these characters, even as they leave and go other places, and then is able to return back to the town. It was fun, I think, to write it because of that sense of authority that the narrative voice has, and that sense of judginess. I think that's something that I definitely enjoy playing with when I'm writing fiction.
Yeah, I definitely go out for a drink with your narrator.
It's the highest praise.
The American writer Brit Bennett in conversation with Monocle's Robert Bound. Still to come, we'll hear how the European Space Agency is seeking a chief space explorer. We'll get a favorite recipe from Ukraine, and I share my selection of toe-tapping summer songs. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You are with The Curator, our weekly highlight show here on Monocle 24. I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Next, we look back to Monday's edition of The Globalist. Unemployment rates are set to rocket post-corona, but at least one opening is being advertised, provided the candidate has the following skills: international experience in one or more of the following areas: political, technical, scientific, economic, administrative. They will have occupied top-level posts in public, semi-public or private organizations. Experience in space-related matters would be highly desirable, and a good knowledge of the European Union role in space matters is also an asset. So, provided you meet those criteria and speak English or French, get your CV into the European Space Agency by the end of August to be in with a chance of becoming the organization's new Director General. Nigel Hambest, professor of astronomy, joined Monocle's Georgina Godwin to tell us what being Europe's chief space explorer really entails, and began by explaining what the ESA actually does.
European Space Agency, well, first of all, it's the third largest space agency in the world, after NASA and the Chinese space agencies. It's a lot bigger than Russia's space agency, for example. So it's got a staff of over 2,000. And if you get the job, you've got a budget of around 7 billion euros to play with, to spend on whatever you want. Well, not quite, of course. It needs approval. And it has a lot of exciting missions going on. At the moment, there's a space probe, an unmanned one, going to explore the sun close up. There's going to be one going to Mars. There's one going to go out to Jupiter's moons. And there's a plan for an amazing one that's going to study black holes in a few years' time. So those are just some of the missions which the new Director General will be picking up on. And of course, so beyond that, they're going to have the opportunity to look at more exciting missions ahead.
How is it funded? I mean, you mentioned billions of dollars, and I know that that comes from several different places, but I wonder if it has a bearing on the nationality of the next director.
Well, there's always politics there, yes, and the Germans put in the largest part of the budget, and then there's France, Italy and Britain. And by the way, although Britain will be leaving the European Union after Brexit, the ESA is not part of the EU. It's a separate body, so that the UK will stay part of it. And so, yes, I mean, there might be a bit of political pressure for the Director General to be one of those major nations. Jan Werner, who's just leaving the job, is German, so it might go to one of the other major players. But of course, it's open to everybody, and the person who has the right talent, and I think the important thing, the right vision, because everyone recognises that space is a visionary thing to get people interested in the universe, but also technology and science. So I think it's open to all.
But are there many suitable candidates? I mean, it's a pretty specific skill set.
It is. I think, well, the person who goes in has to know about space, but I think somebody who's got good political and business nous is going to be just as important as that. And the person will pick up a lot on the job. It's like any job. If you go in with the motivation and the skills, I think you'll pick it up on the way.
Is it as exciting as it sounds, Chief Space Explorer, or is it just largely admin and managerial?
It's a bit of both. I mean, clearly with an organisation like that, with a huge staff, as I said, and 22 countries are involved in it in one way or another, there's a lot of admin involved. But the Director General does have a role in steering the kind of missions. I mean, a lot of it is not just about going out into exploring the planets. We're going back to the moon. And the European Space Agency is very involved in what we call Gateway, which is a manned space station going around the moon and going out further into space with astronauts going to Mars. NASA has built this Orion capsule, which will go to Mars, but the service module, the bit which has got either the power unit and the supplies for the astronauts, that's built by Europe. So we are involved in manned exploration of the rest of the universe. And I think that's really exciting because the new Director General will be able to shape, not the next couple of years because that's set in stone, but beyond that, where we're going to be in, say, 10 years' time.
And finally, he's really responsible for the survival of the human race, being the person that decides when to get rid of asteroids that might pose a threat.
That's another very major role. He or she who takes this job will be protecting us. First of all, space debris, all that clutter which is up there. But as you've said, one of the major missions that they'll be picking up on is a mission to go to an asteroid and try to deflect it. Now, that one is not a particular danger to the Earth, but just to test out the technology. So as and when, and it is a matter of when, as the dinosaurs found out to their cost, when another space rock comes our way to destroy life on Earth, this person will be in a position to say, let's go and move that asteroid out of the way before it gets here. Yeah, so it is a role in saving mankind.
And speaking of dinosaurs, is it likely to be a woman?
Well, I just said he or she. I have got no idea about gender or anything else, or ethnicity. I don't know. I mean, diversity, if you look at the small print, diversity is mentioned there. Whether that will play a role, your guess is as good as mine.
That was Nigel Hambest, Professor of Astronomy, in conversation with Monocle's Georgina Godwin for Monday's edition of The Globalist. Next up on The Curator, we turn to this week's edition of Tall Stories. Governments and city halls around the world have responded to the economic crisis brought about by the coronavirus pandemic in different ways. Some have distributed generous aid packages, others deferred monthly rent or mortgage payments. Still, others have employed a little creativity. Monocle's Alexei Korolev brings us a tale of two cities that he calls home, Vienna and Moscow. While both inspired, their responses could not have been more different. A free meal and a lottery.
Unsolicited junk mail is a fact of life. Is it any wonder some people don't bother to check their mail anymore? But let me tell you this. Last week, everyone here in Vienna was waiting for the postman. I know I was. That's because back in spring, Vienna Mayor Michael Ludwig made a promise. Here it is, straight from the horse's mouth.
Alle Haushalte werden einen Gutschein bekommen. Ein-Personen-Haushalte um 25 Euro, Mehr-Personen-Haushalte um 50 Euro.
When this is all over, he says, every household in the city will get a voucher worth 25 or 50 euros, depending on the size of the household, to be spent in a restaurant or cafe of one's choice, no strings attached. Human nature being what it is, this created far more excitement than any financial support package. Well, I guess that's understandable. Financial support package sounds like an abstraction, but a free meal is a free meal. And so last Tuesday, the vouchers finally began to arrive. And human nature being what it is, some people had a party that same night, I know I did, and some people started fishing through other people's letterboxes. Oh well, it could be worse. At least the Vienna government is doing this out of the goodness of its heart. Have a schnitzel, have a coffee, have a glass of wine. It's on us.
compare and contrast with the approach taken by my home city, Moscow. For the past 5 days, Muscovites, along with the rest of the country, have been voting in a referendum on constitutional reforms that could allow Vladimir Putin to be president for life. There is, of course, no doubt about its outcome. But in order to create an impression of widespread support for the move, the Kremlin needed a big turnout. So what do? They scrap lockdown restrictions, hold a costly and meaningless military parade in Red Square, and offer prizes to people who turn out for the vote. The city of Moscow has gone one better. It is handing out money vouchers in a sort of twisted version of the Devil's Pact. You sell your soul, but you get a new TV. All of this, of course, is being done in the spirit of helping a poverty-stricken population. And the population is rejoicing. Oh well, it could be worse. I mean, Putin could have just said, I'm a dictator. Deal with it. Apart from being the cause of a tragic and unnecessary loss of life, the coronavirus pandemic has also been a remarkably instructive experiment in human nature. And on the evidence of these two examples, we are not doing very well. For Monocle, I'm Alexei Korolev.
From Vienna, we head east next on The Curator as we hear a highlight from the latest edition of Food Neighborhoods. In recent months, the show has taken a slightly different turn, while we all spend a little more time at home, and as such, each week we hear from a top chef or food writer who shares a favorite recipe. This week, Olia Hercules, the author of the brand new Summer Kitchens, shares one of her favorite recipes from Ukraine.
Hi, my name is Olia Hercules. I am a chef and author from Ukraine, and I live in London. One of my favorite Ukrainian recipes that I found in a 1905 Ukrainian cookbook is burnt aubergine on toast with tomatoes and garlic. And it's a very easy one to prepare. Just grab a couple of aubergines. If you can cook them over a barbecue, all for the better. But also you can blister them over a stove or in the oven until they're really nicely soft. You take the skin off. Don't worry if a little bit of skin remains on it. It all adds to flavor. And then while the aubergine is still warm, you just mash it with a fork and then add a knob of really good butter. So they kind of become buttery aubergines. Is just such a beautiful thing. And then the way that you assemble this dish is you take a piece of really good bread and you toast it, or even you can fry it as well or grill it. And then take a little bit of garlic, cut it in half and rub it all over the edges of the toast, and then take a really nice and ripe tomato and almost do what the Spanish do with pan con tomate. So you just rub the tomato over the toast and then top with your buttery aubergine. It's one of my top recipes this summer for sure.
Well, Olia Hercules there, the author of the brand new Summer Kitchens, for the latest edition of Food Neighborhoods. We are nearing the end of the show, but before we go, let me share something I did earlier this week. Monocle's July-August issue is out now, and in it, Monocle's culture editor Chiara Di Mella and myself wrote a selection of toe-tapping summer songs. A proper summer hit wave. From a Texan band to a Norwegian singer-songwriter, it's all covered. Here we are previewing some of the tracks on the special playlist.
First up, I'd like to talk about Rina Sawayama and her song Comme des Garçons. This came out a couple of months ago, but I really think it's such a powerful track that it should definitely figure on our summer playlist, because it is such a female-forward kind of empowering track. Obviously, as we know, the brand that has a very, very similar name has taught many people around the world already that Comme des Garçons means like the boys. And she basically talks about being confident and having that swag and not having to apologize for anything. And she does that on this super beat-heavy kind of disco track, which just is also a joy to listen to. And it just makes you want to hit the dance floor and dance regardless in the most fluid way possible, which I think is something that we should embrace.
Well, let's have a listen then.
Like the boys, I'm so confident.
Well, that's a fantastic choice, Chiara. And I have to say, for those who don't know, she did actually a special remix with Brazil's drag queen, Pablo Vittar, which, you know, such an amazing duo. But I think it was an excellent choice of yours. Love her latest album as well. I'm going to pick something as well from Australia. I think you might like this one. I actually had the pleasure to interview him for the Monaco Weekly as well. His name is Donny Benet. The song is called Mr. Experience. I mean, I love his looks. I mean, as you know, an artist is not only about the music, it's also about the look and kind of the coolness of it. And he described his album as the soundtrack for a dinner party in the 80s. I love that. Shall we have a listen? When you need the one, the one. Amazing. And Donny Benet, a mixture of yacht rock, a little bit of synth, a little bit of dinner party from the 80s. Great for the summer. What's your next choice, Chiara?
Okay, so I'd like to head to LA, actually, to listen to a bit of Perfume Genius. The reason why I love this track, which is On the Floor, is because it's very enjoyable. And again, like, it does what it says on the tin. It will get you on the dance floor. But Perfume Genius is so interesting because he uses his music to, I guess, touch on quite a lot of experimentation. Again, to talk about gender fluidity, it's quite avant-garde music in certain respects at times. But then sometimes on the album, you'll have also these moments that are just so straightforward, so 80s, just so immediately enjoyable. And the reason why I love this song, I think I read somewhere that it's like a little bit Cyndi Lauper as well, and I can see that, you know, it's just got that kind of cheeky, really sunny vibe about it. And I think that's what I love the most about artists who are experimental, that being experimental doesn't mean that you can't be enjoyable, in fact quite the opposite. And I think we should champion artists that are willing to be that kind of future forward. You know, Rina is the same. She uses her music to talk about themes of identity, also racial identity, and what it means to be kind of from different countries and have mixed heritage. All of these things aren't too big a topic for a pop song.
Well, let's have a listen. On the floor, I pace, I run my mouth, I pray and wait. Cross out his name on the page. How long till this washes away? Chiara, thank you so much, because I gotta be honest, before when we're making the playlist, some of the songs you've selected I've knew and I loved it. I didn't know much about Perfume Genius, so I'm really glad you brought the song to the playlist. A very good addition. Now I have something from my own country, if I may. It's the lovely Cell. It's interesting about Cell because, you know, we had many Brazilian artists that are famous abroad, but they're usually kind of the 60s classics, Gilberto Gil or Astrud Gilberto. But from the younger artists, not so many, but Cell managed to do that. So she has quite a good international career, and she just released a new album, which again is a mixture of kind of tropical electronica, a lot of Brazilian samba as well. And the song we're going to hear, it is a summer song, but it's also quite political. Apparently she was talking about the divisiveness of Brazilian politics, but with a lovely tropical electronic sounds, which is great, let's be honest.
Exactly, and if you want to fight the ugliness of Brazilian politics right now, what better way to do it in a lovely package, you know? Fight ugliness with beauty, that's how I feel about it.
I agree. This is Cell with Forçar o Verão, to force the summer. Chiara, we have one more song from your choices. I'm very curious. Which one did you choose now?
Okay, this, I've got to say, is one of my favorites overall on our playlist. I have had the absolute honor to speak to Tuvalu a few months ago upon the release of her Sunshine Kitty album. This is a bit of an offcut from that album that came out a bit later. And it's actually a cover of an original Veronica Maggio song, which originally is in Swedish, but Tuvalu has decided to cover it and bring it into English, I guess, to give it a bit more of a wide audience. And I don't think maybe international speakers would have realized the slight subtle innuendo, not so subtle actually, when the song was in Swedish. In Swedish, it's titled Jag kommer. But it's in English, it's called I'm Coming. Now, I don't know if we want to read into it. Either way, this song is just like an explosion of joy.
And those crescendo beats are fantastic. I love that choice. Let's have a listen. Oh, Chiara, that song, my God. I mean, I can dance that on a dance floor so much. I mean, this year's going to be difficult, but we can do it at home, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've done a couple of dining room kind of parties. Well, I say dining room, it's more front room, a little bit less formal dining, all the same. Yeah, you've got to make the most of the space you've got. And when you're listening to that, it does it for me every time. I can't sit still. So you got to do it. You got to do what you got to do.
Well, and for my last choice, I will stay in Sweden because, let's be honest, it's a great country for music. And is another singer. You know, it's interesting because she, I don't think many people know her outside Sweden, but her music has been the soundtrack of series like Desperate Housewives, Grey's Anatomy. Clearly she has good taste when it comes to TV series. But this is her latest single. I chose the Swedish version. The song is called Komplicerad, but there is actually an English version of the song called It's Complicated. But again, fantastic beats, great voice. I mean, perfect for the summer. Let's have a listen. That was amazing. Chiara, that's such a pleasure. But I mean, we just have six songs, but for those who are actually going to buy our July, August issue, there's plenty more, right?
Yeah, exactly. We have plenty more treats in store. And I guess we cover all of the different kinds of summer music that you might want to listen to. Because I think it's important to remember that the mellow kind of laid back vibe is also important for summer playlist. You know, when you're winding down at the end of a sunny day and maybe you're popping like a bottle of white, very, very chilled wine. And you want that kind of late afternoon vibe? We've got that covered, of course. Our playlist spans all sorts of different countries and all sorts of different styles, but all of it is supposed to just make you happy, I think. And that's what we like to do.
That was Chiara Di Mella speaking to me about the best summer songs this year. You can find the full list on the July-August issue, which is out now. Well, that's all we've got time on this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by the lovely San Impi and presented by me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of the programs here on Monaco 24. Thanks for listening.